You know what's really wild? You never know when to stop pursuing something. When all seems hopeless, sometimes you get a hand from a source you never dreamed was possible. The following audio is only possible because of the folks over at Pratt & Whitney's Dependable Engines Association, who were kind enough to invite project guest Bill Snavely to discuss the latest discoveries out of Buca and a mysterious crash site that's become the center of the Amelia Earhart investigation. You've been asking me for years. Now, in a very special episode of the show, all that was discovered during Buca 2 is finally publicly revealed. This is myself and Bill Snavely in a conversation with Pratt & Whitney's Dependable Engines Association.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Jim Spike. I am the moderator for today's Dependable Engines Association webinar. This is next in our series of webinars, the Dependable Engines Association. I just wanted to give you a little background on Dependable Engines Association. We're really here to promote appreciation, education, awareness of Pratt Whitney's history and heritage. We're outreaching to Pratt Whitney retired community, and our future vision is really to have an outreach through STEM and mentoring also. Previous events have been lessons from the Great Engine War, and our most recent event prior to this was on hydrogen propulsion. So we kind of try to eclipse all the features at Pratt Whitney, all the technology at Pratt Whitney as best we can, and provide a little bit of background. It's really about knowing your history here at Pratt and owning your story. So thank you for joining us this afternoon. I wanted to introduce Debbie Petrell to talk a little bit about the Pratt Whitney Archives, which is going to play a big role in what we're going to talk about today. Debbie?
Thanks, Jim. And I hope that you are all as excited as I am about this webinar today. But before we get started, I'm going to throw some names out at you. Fred Rentschler, Charles Lindbergh, and Amelia Earhart. These are just a few of the well-known names in Pratt & Whitney's rich history. The company has records and stories and amazing images going back nearly 100 years, and they can be found in the Pratt & Whitney Archives. The mission of the Pratt & Whitney Archives is to collect and preserve our organizational knowledge, historical records, and memorabilia so it is available for future generations of aerospace innovators. We hold 10 main collections, which you can see here on the screen, and I actually put stars on some of my favorites. And employees use these materials for anything from researching cost savings potential to diving into lessons learned from our past, or even if they're looking for some great photos to put in offices and conference rooms. We also sometimes hear from members of the general public, such as Bill, who are looking for records and information. And you'll hear a little bit more about that from Bill and Chris today. The Pratt & Whitney Archives are located in the historic Hangar Building on the East Hartford campus, and they're not open to the public. Employees can access the archives by appointment, and we also have a search available on our internal SharePoint site where employees can go in and search for materials that they might need. If you are an RTX or Pratt & Whitney employee and you would like a tour or you would like to access some of the materials in our collections, please feel free to reach out to me. My name is Debbie Petrelli. My contact information is right there on the screen. And now I'll turn things back to Jim to get us started for our main event.
Okay, Debbie, thank you very much for the information on the archives. I think it's a very important part of Pratt Whitney, and I think a little bit overlooked of its importance. But nevertheless, today we have an interesting webinar. I got hooked the first time I heard about it and talked to these gentlemen. Amelia Earhart, is she found? Since 2005, Bill Snavely has been studying and reported aircraft wreck site in the near coastal waters of Buca Island near Papua New Guinea that may prove to be the Lockheed Electra 10E powered by Pratt Whitney Wasp engines in which Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan disappeared in 1937. But I'll just give you a little more background about Bill and Chris. Bill came to us looking and asking about Pratt Whitney Engines came to the right spot. Bill is known as a social worker, pilot, theorist, author, adventurer, and director of Project Blue Angel. He may also go down in history as the one who finally cracked the mystery of what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan on that fateful day in July of 1937. Bill's interest in the disappearance of Amelia Earhart dates all the way back to his childhood when he received a plastic model of Amelia's plane. Over these years, he read many books on the subject and was struck by the difference of all the different theories that were out there. He realized they couldn't all be right, although each one held valuable clues. For nearly 20 years, Bill has been putting his theories to the test and has been studying and recorded aircraft wreck off the coast of Buka Island, and he will be sharing some of the findings with us today. Along with Bill is Chris Williamson. He's the author of Rabbit Hole, The Vanishing of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, and the voice behind the podcast Chasing Earhart and Vanished. Chasing Earhart premiered in 2017, and Chris was hosted over 100 episodes, collaborating with key teams searching for Amelia. In 2018, Chris planned and held the largest panel in history to discuss this topic. Chris has heard it all and has been working closely with Bill for the past 4 to 5 years. Today, he will be sharing his insights and a lot of the history around Amelia Earhart and her disappearance. These two fellows have, as you can see, have been working on this for a long time and really anxious to hear some results today. So, Chris, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So we thought what we'd do, folks, is just kind of give you like a little visual to start this whole thing off. We're deciding to play the trailer that we cut a few years ago, and it hasn't really been seen in a lot of public areas. So here's the trailer. Here's a little visual, and then we'll get started.
I picked up the phone, and that's when I first spoke to Bill Snavely. And he began to tell me the story about how they might have found this aircraft. It might be Amelia Earhart.
If I'm right, what they did, the decisions they made were the correct ones.
Amelia's Electra had specific modifications done to it for her specific journey. And the fact that some of those unique modifications appear to have been verified in the wreckage that's been found, we really do believe that it's very likely that this is the real thing.
It was directly on her flight path, and it was in an area never searched by anybody.
And I brought this glass, this piece of glass, back to the boat.
The more I talked to him, the more convinced I was that he might really be onto something.
What we've found so far is consistent with the plane she flew.
This is the first man to have time, distance, and fuel all correct.
Let's just find it.
People want closure. They want answers. And there are so many mysteries in the world now that go unsolved. It would be nice once in a while to get one that is solved. It may be a missing piece of history.
If indeed this is Amelia Earhart's aircraft, this will rewrite history.
Her plane literally would have fallen out of the skies at 19 hours and 10 minutes had she proceeded and said, I'm flying there to Howland anyway. It didn't.
It's the one hypothesis that actually has a plane.
This accident site is something that the locals have protected for 81 years.
The islanders, they have such a different life. They are amazing. They are resilient. They are strong. They can freedive to 100 feet. They grow all their own food. They build their own houses. They carve their own boats.
This is the only twin-tailed aircraft in the 30s to be lost in the Pacific.
Every checkbox so far has been checked as to, is this her airplane or not?
This thing could be solved with this.
This is not the ending. This is a new beginning.
It really felt like this particular place would reveal what it wanted to reveal. When it was ready to.
Is there a simpler explanation for the whole thing?
It's the plane. It's her plane.
Hi, I'm Bill Snavely, head of Project Blue Angel. I'm delighted to talk with you today. I grew up at Storrs, Connecticut. Both my parents were pilots, and so was I. I'm also a scuba diver and received my master's degree in social work from the University of Connecticut.
Growing up, I lived overseas for 3 years and learned the value of oral history. I have a curiosity for unsolved mysteries. My curiosity grew when I realized 70% of Amelia Earhart's route was never searched. Amelia was a courageous pilot, scholar, poet, author, and mentor to women and young girls. Amazingly, she is still as popular today. Fred Noonan, Amelia's navigator, was trained first on ships and became Pan Am's best navigator, according to his bosses. In 2005, I retired from Maryland State Service and flew to Rabaul in Papua New Guinea with a simple plan. I wanted to track Amelia's flight from Ley, New Guinea, covering the 70% of her flight that was never searched, one island at a time, starting close to her takeoff, incorporating Native oral history. I planned to make 6 island studies, one a year, until I reached the Gilbert Islands. I never expected to be lucky on my first trip to Rabaul at the Hamamas Hotel where I stayed. 3 policemen from 3 different provinces were being trained by a trainer from Australia. As I rode to the airport getting ready to leave Rabaul, the 3 policemen asked me what I was doing in Rabaul, because Rabaul is well off the beaten path. I told them I was searching for Amelia Earhart's airplane. Dominic Chara, the quietest of the 3, sat behind me. He spoke up and said he knew of an unidentified plane underwater near Buka at Matsungan Island. He asked me to give him 5 characteristics of her plane and told me to call him in 3 weeks. I did, and all 5 characteristics matched. Buka is the easternmost island of Papua New Guinea and the northernmost island of the Solomon Islands. A boy on the beach at Matsungan saw the plane come down through a fierce thunderstorm, both engines still running, but almost out of gas at 20 hours, 14 minutes Greenwich Mean Time, or about 6 a.m. local time. The plane landed on a quay just off the beach. He said they were working their radios. Swift current moved the plane, and it went down a steep slope underwater, 109 feet below. The boy on the beach was called a liar. Due to the loud thunderstorm, they hadn't heard the plane crash, and it had already gone underwater. It wasn't until Teolo, a sponge diver, in 1995 that the plane was spotted during one of his free dives. In 2001, the boy who witnessed the plane ditch died. During a stopover in Indonesia, Furman Gray and a team from Lockheed, according to Furman, replaced her engines with powerful Senior Wasp engines, which would be needed on takeoff at Ley, New Guinea. Ley presented a real problem for Amelia and Fred. Lockheed's envelope said the plane couldn't weigh more than 15,300 pounds in order to take off on a paved 3,000-foot runway. They loaded the plane right up to the 15,300 pounds with 950 gallons of fuel, or at weighted capacity, and tried to take off from Ley on an unpaved runway. At 10 a.m. takeoff, it was so hot, oil drums on the ground were pinging as they expanded in the sun. A Pan Am pilot flying overhead reported as the plane roared down the runway, it bounced into the air in the final 50 yards at the point where a road crossed the runway. As pilots know, it was in ground effect. In essence, the ground was still supporting it. When it went over the cliff at the end of the runway, it then carved circles 6 feet above the water until it flew out of sight. What a powerful, durable, dependable set of engines those were. You all should be very proud at Pratt Whitney. As they flew at altitude, they flew into a 26-mile-an-hour headwind, which was sustained at 20 knots at Howland. The South Pacific trade winds were not known until the British discovered it in 1943. The first third of the route, Amelia thought she was flying at 150 miles an hour, which she reported. 20 minutes later, she was able to factor in ground speed when she flew over to Nikumono Islands, and she found she was flying at less than 107 nautical miles an hour and was an hour late to that point. Police Chief Cade heard Emilio on his Kent Atwater shortwave when she flew over Nauru's phosphate lights at night. She was an hour and a half late, behind schedule. Gas level was down to under 322 gallons left, and she was just over halfway. She would have needed 428 plus gallons to come into Howland on fumes. On the fly, they turned back toward Buka, the only airport they could still reach. Emilio turned just after midnight, Greenwich Mean Time. If she had not turned back, Emilio's plane would have fallen out of the skies at 19 hours and 10 minutes, Greenwich Mean Time. It didn't. She had five more communications right up to 2014, Greenwich Mean Time. Emilio was able to shift from a burn rate of 48 plus gallons per hour to 38 gallons per hour with a tailwind by turning back. Buka had a 2,300-foot runway they had flown over on their way toward Howland. Unfortunately, it was now covered and obscured by a violent thunderstorm they couldn't get under without peril. The rest was witnessed by the boy on the beach. To date, I've paid for seven dives by five dive teams, and they've located a femur head and three teeth. One of the labs indicated on a number of samples a male of European origin. Fred Noonan was of European origin. We also have a landing light that says axe brand with two axe handles pointing up, like a close-up of a picture of her landing light. Time, distance, and fuel all match up. We can tell by the short, stubby fender the plane's a Lockheed, and by the landing light it's a Lockheed Electra 10. Six Lockheed Electra 10s went down near Australia and New Zealand. Only one in the area is still missing. Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra 10E. According to divers in our pictures, the match between our plane and Amelia's is as follows. Twin tails, twin engines, door in the back on the pilot's side, entry to the cockpit through the navigator's hatch, no doors up front, toothpick props, meaning it's not a warbird, loop on the top of a cockpit broken off with the base visible, wheels for steering, not sticks, long-range fuel tanks inside the plane, filler ports on pilot's side, directly on the route she flew in an area never searched, short, stubby fender on wheels, measures the same length as Amelia's plane by divers in 2012, time, distance, and fuel all match, and DNA of a European ancestor. Now, today is the first time the cleaned lens glass will be viewed, and I'm showing it for the first time publicly with it actually cleaned off. There are challenges at this point for us. Certainly the coral is replacing the aluminum and metals on the plane due to 86 years underwater. We need to get to the engines as soon as we can. I'm sure we'll need Pratt Whitney's expertise in checking serial numbers if they'll help us with their records. If you want to read more, I have two books that I've written, and they can be gotten at www.specialbooks.com. The first is Tracking Amelia Earhart, Her Flight Path to the End. The second is Lost in Flight, Amelia Earhart, Giving Cover as a Decoy for a Spy Plane. Remember the little engine that could? Those powerful WASP engines did. They did endure, and they were reliable and running right up until Amelia ran out of gas. Chris will now tell you more about a need for a third trip to Buka to recover the engines, and will cover any of the areas I may have missed.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate that. And thank you for having me here, everybody. Pratt & Whitney, this is a true honor. Amelia, as you all know, I'm sort of preaching to the choir here, but Amelia really loved Pratt & Whitney. Amelia was obsessed with them, frankly. She used them for her Vega. I apologize for my spelling error there on the slide, but she used them for her Vega on the transatlantic flight. And she definitely wanted to go back to Pratt when it came time for the world flight, which was really the last hurrah for Amelia Earhart. They had sort of mortgaged their future to make this world flight a reality, and given everything they had, and ultimately paid with their lives in the end for an attempt at this world flight. So Amelia's relationship with Pratt ran really, really deep. She met with several Pratt executives all the way up to the world flight, all the way up to the original takeoff in California from Oakland to Hawaii. They even met with some Pratt folks over in Hawaii. I know Paul Mance, her technical advisor, met with Pratt folks and was in constant contact with Pratt throughout the process. And even when Amelia ground looped the aircraft on March 20th of 37 and changed the whole direction of the flight, when the aircraft was brought back via the SS Lure Line to Burbank to be rebuilt, Amelia insisted that the Wasp engines go right back where they were. So she believed in the Wasp engines, she believed in Pratt, she believed in Lockheed, and she wanted those the brands to stand basically with her, beside her, as she made world history. And unfortunately, Amelia, well, she did make world history, but not for the ways that she intended on making it. So Pratt, it was a huge piece of Amelia's life professionally. George Putnam, it was a huge piece of his life professionally. They all had really good working relationships with Pratt. And as you can tell by what Debbie said earlier, Pratt's always had a very good relationship with Earhart historical documentation and some of the things that they have that can sort of verify what we've been talking about today. I know Bill went through a bunch of evidence, and so I thought what I would do is just put that on the screen here, because that is an earful of evidence that Bill went through. So I want you guys to really just basically take a chance to take a look at what we've gathered so far. This has not come without massive sacrifice from Project Blue Angel and its team. They have gone through everything over the course of the last 15 years to walk this thing backwards to prove that it's anything other than Amelia Earhart's aircraft. They really have done the work. I've seen it, I've witnessed it, and it's pretty incredible. I'm just going to point out a couple of quick things and kind of like lean into a couple of quick things that Bill mentioned. The time, the distance, and the fuel all match Earhart's flight path and her endpoint. And at the endpoint, there happens to be an aircraft. So no theory in the history of this case has ever produced an aircraft until now. No theory has ever started with an aircraft and worked its way backwards to try to get an understanding of how that aircraft may have ended up there until now. Everything that's been found, including very specific things, you could make up a 55-foot wingspan or, you know, a 39.5-foot length plane, and you could make up certain things, and that could be similar to other planes potentially. But when you start getting into the loop antenna, and you start getting into the fuel ports in the right spot, and the navigator's hatch, and you start seeing potentially empty fuel containers in the cargo, it starts to really add up. And this site has been screaming at us to investigate it properly for the last, you know, 87 years. And Bill has done everything he can to make sure that that gets done. But, you know, we need Pratt's help as far as identification. Our goal right now is to plan one final expedition out to Buca. And I am very proud to say that in the history of the case, this is the very first cross theory investigation ever in the history of the case, which is a huge deal if you're someone in my position, because for the longest time, everybody's been in their own camps. Everybody's been in their own positions, showing their own evidence and stating why everybody else is wrong and they're right. Bill is actually stating, hey, this could be the plane. We don't know for sure, but it looks awfully close. It needs to be investigated. People are actually starting to become convinced that Bill is onto something very big here. And so this Buca 3 is going to take several big names from other expeditions and other major theories out to Buca to help Bill determine once and for all if this is the plane or if this is just a plane. And there are multiple possibilities. We could get out there. This could be a Lockheed Electra 10E and it could not be Earhart's. And if that's the case, then it literally will rewrite history, because we have walked back every Lockheed Electra that's ever been made. And we have determined only one is missing from the Lockheed 10E line, and that's Earhart's. So if there's a second one there that's not Earhart's, then we have a big problem. Things like that are very much so worth us going out to Buca, finalizing this thing, finishing it once and for all, and potentially eliminating a massive theory, because that's, in my opinion, how you fix these things, is you will try to eliminate theories until you're only left with the truth. And this is a big one. You got to start with this. This has now become the elephant in the room. So you have to go out and deal with what Bill has put forward now and try to prove that this plane is not Earhart's and rule it out, or rule it in and rewrite history. And that's what we think. That's what we feel. As you can tell by the trailer, everybody on the team really just feels that way. Everybody who's ever put hands on that plane, including the local divers there that really don't know anything about the history or anything, really feel that this is the plane. You know, we've had people that came out there that are very skeptical about it, put hands on it, were down there underwater, spent time in there, and they're like, it's definitely what Bill says it is. So we are in a position now of finalizing this Buca 3 trip, this historic Buca 3 trip, to potentially put an end to this forever. And that's basically why I'm involved, is I'm trying to get everybody collectively together into one unit to try to help Bill fix this and finish this for good. So that's where we're at. I'm happy to take any questions anybody has. And Jim, if you want to take over, I'm happy to answer anything I can. And Bill is, of course, happy to answer anything that he can. And then we'll just continue from there.
Yeah. So I guess I'd just like to start, Bill, with what makes the glass so special that you showed?
The thing that's special about the glass is a number of features. Number one, there's a close-up of her airplane that Purdue had, and there's a guy on a stepladder who's taking a picture of the plane, and his son takes a picture of his dad taking the picture. And it's close enough up that on the left landing light I can actually see the individual axe handles were actually pointed up on her plane. And I said, wow, that's crazy. Why would they do that? And then I looked at the glass that we had and I realized that ours was the same. It has a carve out at the 10 o'clock and the 2 o'clock area. You can actually see on the close up of her plane in the photograph exactly the same thing. Apparently, this glass was blown against a mold. Apparently, the backing for it was machine made and absolutely round. They had to fit the two together, and the only way to do it was to grind it down at the 10 and grind it down at the 2 and 4. And the glass we've got shows exactly the same thing as in that picture of it. The other things are, I checked and talked to Lockheed. Lockheed said that they didn't have background on it, but they thought Grimes made it. I went over to Grimes, and Grimes is now a subsidiary of Honeywell. And the company is actually started back in 1934. So it could quite possibly be Grimes. But the thing that really got my attention was there's a sister ship over in Auckland that ground looped back in the 50s, and it's in a museum. And I had them actually take a measurement of the actual piece that the glass fits against, and it fit like a glove as far as the dimensions.
And the indentations, we should say, too. So like the indentations fit, the dimensions fit, everything fit. So again, that, you know, not a slam dunk, but the odds just keep continuing to climb. So every time there's a piece of evidence that's found, or every time there's something that's found, especially everybody wants to talk about DNA. There is certainly DNA. And we have been working with, we can't unfortunately name the lab, but it's one of the top labs on the planet when it comes to DNA. During Buka 2, they found what they thought was just a bunch of junk. They didn't know anything. And it was actually found, one of the questions that was asked, where was the teeth and stuff found? It was found actually in the cockpit in relation to where they would have been sitting, which makes it even more, you know, insane, because if it was found, you know, 100 yards away, the odds of it being them, it's probably a little bit slimmer. But if it's found in the cockpit and it's determined to be bones and teeth and they're human teeth and all the DNA starts to match, you know, male of Eastern European descent, well, that's one. If we get out there for Buka 3 and we find a second set of DNA in there and it happens to be a female, what are the odds of that? A million to one, 100 million to one at that point in time. So like then it becomes, we have to get out there. The downside about this is it's working against, you know, the coral and the underwater nautical environment there is working against us by the day. And we don't know how cooperative it's going to be. That's why we're going after the engines. That's why we've talked to Pratt, is because we know that there's parts in those engines that maybe weren't made of some of the same material that the rest of the plane was made of. So we might be able to pull something from the engine or maybe pull the engine itself if possible. We'll have the equipment for that this time. If we can pull the engine or pull a piece of the engine that Pratt can verify, then we're sort of in a checkmate status at that point. I mean, because what are the odds of that being anything other than her plane at that point? Then you have to get, you know, you have to get really serious about that. Not that we're not now, of course, but you have to really get serious because that's her plane out there. It belongs in a museum, you know, to quote Indiana Jones. It belongs in a museum, or, you know, this could be an underwater tomb. It could be an underwater museum at this point. So we don't know what we're dealing with until we get out there, but it's certainly looking positive.
When is the third Buka supposed to occur then in time?
Buka 3 is being worked out as we speak. We're about 60% of the way there. We have a developer on board. We're trying to get distribution on board. We'll probably know in about 2 or 3 weeks if we're going to be able to make it out this year. So I know Bill was initially looking at maybe potentially October, but we're not sure if we're going to be able to make that time frame. But as soon as we can physically get out there to do Buka 3, we are going to do it. And the wheels are certainly well in motion now to get this done.
The sooner the better, because every day goes by, it's deteriorating more. I should add also, on one of the teeth, I had a retired oral surgeon from Johns Hopkins look at the tooth. He said it was an upper incisor, and it was definitely not Oriental.
Which rules out a lot of different types of planes. Like I know a lot of people in the beginning, when this first sort of broke, people were considering that this was maybe a Zero, or it was something similar to that, or something very similar to, you know, maybe a different kind of plane, but very similar in dimension. You know, I think the DNA with what we've found so far and some of their stuff that's been found that you're seeing on your screen right now, that really does, it really does line up. You know, one of the questions in chat was talking about time, distance, and trajectory. And like, those all seem like really logical clues. And, you know, why was that not considered? That's an excellent question. I think everybody was thinking about Howland Island at the time, because she was saying things like, we must be on you, but cannot see you. Gas is running low, you know, things of that nature, you know, and if you look at the call logs, it shows that she was maybe around Howland Island. But Bill, I can turn this over to Bill, basically has a really wonderful, simple explanation for how that could have happened. And it has to do with something that I think everybody knows. And I'll turn it to Bill. Bill, why were they in Buka and not near Howland?
Yeah, the key thing is for years and years and years, because of a S5 call out that Bellert reported, said they sounded like they were right outside of the Itasca. What happened was there was Skip. She was on her night frequency of 3105 at the time. The evidence shows that an S5 back then was all subjective based on what was heard, not an actual dial. But I do think it came in as an S5. At the 3105 night frequency on Skip, it can come in as an S5 for 3,000 miles. They were literally 1,750 miles away at the time. So they were well within the area. The thing that was conducive was it was near the equator, it was summertime, it was nighttime, and it was the greatest sunspot evidence since 1879. It was even visible to the naked eye. All those things are conducive to it. Plus, there was one feature that nobody had picked up before, and that was the fact that the Itasca has them circling it at 19 hours and 28 minutes. They were circling to try to get a sunline facing east. These are smart guys. And as they were turning, the Itasca recorded that they were turning, and that's when the S5 was reported and written down by Bellert and Galton. The interesting piece is that was the first time Itasca and the plane were facing each other, because up until then, the plane was flying away from them until it did the circle. And that was exactly the point in time. And the reason why it would have been louder was because there was no tail aluminum that would interfere with it. So it fits perfectly. And then if you look at his rough notes, Galton writes 46 minutes later at close to 2014, S5 question mark. Why the question mark? Is that because it's not as loud anymore?
Number 13 there, you know, you talk about the luggage that was housed in the fuselage.
Yeah.
Have you been able to gain access to the fuselage, go inside of it?
Here's the deal on that, and I didn't even put it into this summary. I looked at the pictures that we had from about 2012, and there was a gap in the nose cone. And I went to a guy from Lockheed that I knew and said, how come this 4-foot by 3-foot section is sitting down on the ground? And he laughed at me, and he said, Bill, the rivets rusted through. So I'm looking into it. I see what appears at the time as a suitcase. It's got GP initials on it.
Yep.
I'm thinking, that's crazy. I had forgotten that her husband, George Putnam, flew with her from California all the way to Miami and then got out of the plane.
That's right.
Well, anyway, I called up the nearest relative, and I won't name her. And I said, why was Amelia flying with her husband's luggage? And she said, I'm shocked. And I've never heard her use that louder expression. And I said, why are you shocked? And she said, because I thought you were looking in the wrong place. So the family knew. Unfortunately, that piece is no longer there. The earthquakes, the storms, and everything have moved that right out of there. It's not even there anymore.
Jim, just to answer Margie's question, she asked about local divers. Bill, I might want to pose this to you because I think it's important too, just for the historical aspects. She asked if we're concerned that local divers may have already taken crucial evidence that'll help you prove it was AEs. Are we concerned about that? Or how can you talk a little bit about your relationship with Buka?
The thing is, at 109 feet, it's very hard to get down to that level. The only thing that the locals outside of Matsungan Island were hoping was there would be gold on the plane. Mm-hmm. And I said, any gold that's on the plane, please keep. I don't want any. I just am interested in historical facts about this. But at 109 feet, even our divers can only be down for about 12 minutes. Everything is so encased at this point in time that aside from the suitcase that eventually washed out of that area, there really isn't anything other than chipping away at the coral and at the debris that's remaining in the cockpit.
I will say for Buca 3, we are going to have some very serious equipment in play that we never had prior, which is really good, courtesy of some friends of ours that are going to be joining Buca 3 and people that I never in a million years thought would join Buca and look at this. But we will have some very serious equipment out there this time. So we'll be able to spend some more time underwater. We'll be able to actually spend some more time with ROVs underwater. I will say you guys might have caught at the end of the trailer that there was a GoFundMe link. That's an old GoFundMe. What we did with that was we were able to raise about $3,500 and get somebody, a gentleman by the name of Mike Orange, over with a ROV. And as part of Buca 2, he was able to take the first underwater ROV footage of the aircraft. And it's really stunning. And we're hoping to release some of that to those original donors. So we're not currently looking for, you know, a GoFundMe right now. I just wanted to kind of put that out there in case people were curious about that or had asked about that. You can hit projectblueangel.com, and that will be really the best place for you to go to find any new information. Project Blue Angel is also on Facebook. You can follow, you know, Chasing Earhart and Vanished on Facebook. We're always talking about Project Blue Angel because people are always asking us about it. You can definitely find more about the expedition of Buca 3 there. And of course, you can grab, you know, Bill's books. And if you want to grab mine, that would be great too.
And in the www.specialbooks.com is a whole lot more information than I can give you, you know, in 45 minutes to an hour today about the locations and the efforts that were made.
So all the information of this next Buca 3 could be found on Project Blue Angel, right? On Facebook, you said, Chris?
On both. Yeah. So Project Blue Angel, once it's officially announced and we've got the distribution on board and we're going through with it and we've got a hard date and everything, that'll all be updated on both projectblueangel.com. It'll be updated on Project Blue Angel's Facebook. So if you just search them on Facebook, you'll see that. And then if you search Vanished on Facebook, or if you search Chasing Earhart on Facebook, it'll all be there as well. So we try to share all the updates from all the active investigations going on. You know, there's multiple theories, as everybody on this webinar probably is aware. Those don't stop just because this one's gaining momentum. I'm also trying to help support every theory out there. But this one, like I said, Bill is very humble. This is a different approach, guys. It really is. It's just feels different than anything else that's ever been done before. And I think going out there to investigate this aircraft is in everybody's best interest at this point, because now it's gotten to the point now where we kind of have to deal with it. It's now beyond this is impossible, or it's just way too far away, or it's beyond any of the automatic dismissal arguments. Those have been taken care of for years now. And every expedition we get out there, more stuff gets, you know, discovered, and it just gets crazier and crazier. So now we're at the point now where it's like, you know, we got all this evidence here and this is all confirmed. This isn't speculation. This is all stuff that people have laid eyes on, laid hands on, things of that nature. Like we've verified these things. And so now it's at a point where we have to go back and we have to finish this.
Bill or Chris, would you like to close this session out? It's been very interesting. First, I want to thank you for being here, for giving us a look at this Amelia Earhart again. I'm excited to think that we could pull something off the engines and verify the serial numbers of these engines. I think that would be a great part of the story. Maybe close a lot of it out, you know, and maybe bring up some of the aircraft. I don't know if that's possible or not. You guys are the experts on that. I'll give you guys the final words.
I'll let Chris end it, but I just like to say thank you so much for allowing us to share with you what we've been looking at. And I am stunned by the incredible durability and endurance of those engines Pratt Whitney made. Those WASP engines were something else, really powerful.
Just to piggyback off that real quick, I know somebody asked about other theories in there, and I won't go too long because I know we only have a few moments. I will say, though, just to mention one other theory that's very popular, the Nick and Mororo theory or the castaway theory. Even in that theory, and I'm only mentioning that because it does pertain directly to Pratt & Whitney, the theory basically states that they were able to land the aircraft on Nick and Mororo on a coral atoll there, and during low tide, Earhart was able to run the radios and send post-loss radio signals or radio distress calls, and she knew that the engines needed to be running when so she could actually reuse her radio. And in high tide, obviously she had to stop doing that. And that theory states that she did that off and on for several nights. Those engines on crash on a coral atoll and in Buca held up. These engines were very, very strong. I mean, there was a reason why she loved Pratt & Whitney so much. Those engines were really the heart and soul of that aircraft. You take those engines out of the aircraft, it's just another aircraft, but you put those in and it makes it Earhart's Electra, which is, in my opinion, the holy grail of aviation. Certainly one of the biggest holy grails of historical mystery ever. We're beyond honored that Pratt & Whitney would show any kind of interest in Buca and what's going on out there, because this is something we've been working on for a long time. I'm especially proud to be part of this team, to be with Bill on this, to help Bill in any way that I can. And I'm honored to be here today. So thank you for having me, and thank you for having Bill, yeah. Certainly.
It's certainly our pleasure. we hope to hear from you again. We're going to keep on your tail as we go through discovering more about this aircraft, because I find it extremely interesting. I think people at Pratt Whitney find it extremely interesting. And you can see by the number of participants we had today, that Amelia Earhart is still in the heart of Pratt. So once again, gentlemen, thank you. It's been great to have you, and we'll be back to talk with you again.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for having us. We really appreciate it.
And thanks to Debbie, of course, and you'll be talking with her more in the archives, hopefully, once we get a serial number up, right?
I sure hope so. I sure hope this is only the beginning. Yes. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you, Pratt. We really appreciate you all.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.